What I'm going to do is to try to say some things about various predicates of Jesus. Tonight, Jesus, the risen Lord, and the general perspective is that the gospel is promise. But before we start this, I want to share something with you. A bit of news to start with. Four years ago, my contact with Holden was to encourage Michael Moeller to come up here. Michael was at that time the first person from East Germany who was allowed to come to America a whole year without being married to anybody, which they used as a hostage for one of our visiting professors at Trinity Seminary in Columbus, Wolfgang Ullmann, who was allowed to come for 3 months, but he had a wife and family back in East Germany, so they knew he'd come back. Michael they let out without any guarantee that he would come back, and he did. But now he is the, and I arranged for him to come here to Holden, and he spent the month of June here, and now he is the ambassador of East Germany to the United States of America.
Wow.
It's wonderful. Yes, he is. And on July 1st, what?
I hiked the Image Lake with him, boy.
Oh! who showed me a, here, Bill. Showed me a picture of Michael in a kayak on Puget Sound, was it?
It was a great time, yeah.
So Michael and his wife Tina, who had a baby last December in Columbus, moved into the ambassador's residence in Washington, D.C. Anybody who knows him can go there for the next 6 months, because that's about all it's going to last. When it's over, when Michael is through being ambassador to the United States, he will go to the Lutheran Theological Seminary in Philadelphia as professor of systematic theology. And what will happen after that, of course, nobody knows. But Michael is an original mind and had a great experience here at Holden. So we have had here at Holden an ambassador. I think that's marvelous. We ought to celebrate it.
A couple weeks ago.
Well, pardon?
We had a governor here a couple weeks ago.
A governor?
Yeah, we've got big shots coming on.
Oh, that's nothing like an ambassador. I mean, my goodness. Mere governor is elected. Okay. The second thing is that my sons, who grew up here at Holden practically, said that I could get by with the same theology that I've always had, but not the same jokes. And so, and so they sent me for Christmas, at least one of them, Greg, a book by Richard Lederer called Anguished English. And it is full of wonderful new jokes, and I will read some every day. So if you don't come away with anything else, you'll at least come away with some new jokes. One of the things that Lederer is a professor of English, and these are all foibles of the English language, but these are some translations into English. In a Bucharest hotel lobby, this elevator is being fixed for the next day. During that time, we regret that you will be unbearable. A sign posted in Germany's Black Forest. This is my favorite. It is strictly forbidden on our Black Forest camping sign that people of different sex, for instance, men and women, live together in one tent unless they are married with each other for that purpose. Okay. A Paris hotel elevator, please leave your values at the front desk. Menu in a Swiss restaurant, our wines leave you nothing to hope for. These are good. In a Copenhagen ticket office, we take your bags and send them in all directions.
You're pretty racist.
They're pretty good. What I'm going to do in this series is an outgrowth of the work that we have been doing for a number of years in the Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue. In 1983, I was appointed to be a member of the third series of current Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue. Lutheran Episcopal Dialogue began about 100 years ago when the Anglican Church, the Church of England, tried to pick off the Church of Sweden from the Lutherans and didn't succeed. Hooray for the Swedes. I just wanted to say that up here at Holden and in public on living tape. And the modern Lutheran Episcopal conversations began in 1968 and have been going on now for about 22 years. The first series ended somewhat inconclusively. The second series ended in 1982 with the declaration of interim Eucharistic sharing between Lutherans and Episcopalians. And the third series is about to end in January after 15 sessions, some of them door-slamming, walk-out, acrimonious conversations. That's one of the things that happens. But about midway through the dialogue, we finished work on a document called Implications of the Gospel, which has since been sent to every pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and with a study guide so that it can be used for lay study, and above all for study between Lutherans and Episcopalians. And I'm just going to follow the progression of the chapters in this book as we talk this week about the nature of the gospel. Let me say just a word about my involvement in this. I'm a systematic theologian. I sort of hate to admit that, but because systematic theologians don't really have a discipline of their own, like biblical scholars and historians and people who teach something like practical education or preaching. I'm always embarrassed when my mother says, "What is it just exactly that you do?" I feel like a member of the mafia, you know. Don't ask. Because what we try to do is a little bit of everything. Basically, systematic theologians are theorists of Christianity who try to say this is what, how Christianity works when it works authentically. When I first came to Holden back in 1967, I tried to describe being a systematic theologian like the person at the top of the mountain who is asked by a car driver, "Is this hill safe?" And the answer is yes, it's down at the bottom that everybody has the wrecks. And so the systematic theologian is the one who tries to look farther down to the bottom and see where the wrecks are, so that the way we're driving the car on the road at the present time doesn't lead to a crash. What I did in Implications of the Gospel is testimony to Oscar Wilde's, or a commentary on Oscar Wilde's statement that only the poor are required to practice the virtue of poverty. Only ecumenical theologians are required to practice the virtue of anonymity. The book is recorded as edited by William Norgren and William Rush, but Bill Peterson and I wrote it, and 22 people agreed with all the words in it. It took us about 2 years to get that agreement, and maybe it'll be on sale in the bookstore. That is yet uncertain. It's important for us, I think, to start with the resurrection, and above all, to get it right. I have a wonderful cartoon in my study at home. It's a deputy cartoon. The deputy walks in and one character says to him, "Happy Easter, deputy," And the deputy stands there with a stocking in his hand and he says, "I didn't find a single Easter egg in my stocking this morning." And the sheriff yells at him and says, "You nincompoop, Christmas is for hanging stockings. Easter is for Easter baskets. You celebrate Easter by hunting for Easter eggs to put in your Easter basket." And as the deputy walks away crestfallen, the sheriff says, "Gad, that boy's grasp of theology is pathetic." So the point of the session today is that our grasp of theology not be pathetic. But I want to make as a kind of basic point today that the resurrection is really the starting point for everything that is characteristically Christian. And I mean that to be taken as seriously as I can. It is certainly the starting point for the Christian gospel. Now, I don't know how any of you learned stories of the Christian gospel. I try to think back sometimes to my own memories, my own earliest memories of stories of Christianity. One of them is Elsie Eggemeyer's Bible History book. Yeah. And it was a kind of classic account of telling the Christian story. And it began with creation as a kind of sort of setting of the stage. And at that point, you could already wipe out any real concern for creation, because really all you were doing was just sort of arranging the props. And we blew it very early in the play, and then somehow or other the whole rest of the story was God's great attempt to fix up or repair whatever it was that had gone wrong early. That's an interesting way of doing the Christian narrative, of doing the Christian story, but there's a sense in which, because of the kind of world we live in today, it really won't wash as an authentic way of telling the Christian story. It won't wash partly, I think, because we don't really know any longer, or we can't really assume any longer in our culture, that God as a reality is the overarching context within which life is understood. For the vast majority of the people in Western civilization, God is no longer that overarching context. And therefore, what happens is that Elsie Eggemeyer telling of the Christian story ends up being a kind of idiosyncrasy, a sort of thing that Christians are into, but that doesn't really have to be taken seriously by people who are flying rocket ships to the moon, or trying to manage the national debt, or devise a budget, or run for re-election, or settle all the problems of a post-Cold War world. And in fact, we don't even want people who do those things to have anything to do with an overarching God concept. So the result of all of this is that the Christian story is regarded as a nice and probably harmless way of occupying Sunday mornings for people who otherwise don't use it to function in their contexts. My doctor happens to be an Episcopalian, but if he ever began a session with me with "Let us pray," I'd run from the office. I don't want him to have anything to do with religion. I want him to use all the latest stuff out of the medical journal to examine me. So the question for us today, in part, is how do we start the story in a way that can engage the full range of the realities of our world? And I think that's a tremendous challenge for Christian theology today, but also for the whole of the Christian community, so that we aren't just a comfortable little ghetto. It was very moving last night to hear Carol Tomer challenge us with her sermon and the image of playing church, so that we are not just sort of playing at church and up here are able to play it better and with less distraction than we have to do out in the real world. I'm trying to have us ask the most fundamental questions possible, namely, how can we account for what it is that Christianity is up to in such a way that it affects everything we are and do. Now, one strategy for that is to just look at what is central to Christianity, namely that thing that we call the gospel. Gospel, as we all know, is Old English for news, good news. But news, as the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or U.S. News and World Report or Time Magazine or anybody else reports it to us, news is what has just happened. If it's more than a couple of days old, if it's more than a week old, it isn't news anymore, it's history. I can let my Time magazines accumulate, as I often do when I'm busy, and still go back to them, because essentially time is already history. It's a week old by the time you get it. In what sense then can Christianity be called news? That is, something which has, in a sense, happened recently. It can't be news in that sense, because everything that we hold as essential to being Christians happened a long time ago, several thousand years or more. One exception to all of that is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, if indeed it happened. It's a question, but let's at least say that that's an exception, because if it did happen, then it remains as fresh as the New York Times delivered this morning to your doorstep, or what's the thing they give you now in the motels? It's USA Today, that's what it is. As fresh as the current issue of USA Today. For no one before or no one since has been raised from the dead. I mean, if it happened once, it's going to be news forever. And that's why I want to maintain as a kind of beginning proposition that the starting point for anything Christian is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And it is, in fact, the basic proclamation of the New Testament. Now, it doesn't always look that way. In fact, it doesn't always leap out at us in the Bible itself that that's basic. Back when I was a pastor in Albany, New York, I had an experience that a lot of pastors in city parishes have. Somebody called up and said, "Would you visit my wife in the hospital? She's a member of St. Matthew's." Well, I couldn't find her on the books, but I went to the hospital, and it turned out that she was an elderly woman who was dying of cancer in the hospital and had at one time, long ago, been baptized at St. Matthew's. In the course of things, I went to visit her husband, and that was the most interesting event of all. Her husband was a 80-year-old man at the time, a kind of roustabout who'd been raised in an orphanage in Canada, and never in his life had any contact with Christianity at all, never. In the course of continuing to visit him as well as his wife dying in the hospital, he asked to be instructed in the Christian faith, and I took along a little copy of Luther's Catechism and I instructed him, and in the course of time baptized him and took some parishioners with me every time I went to celebrate the Lord's Supper in his home. Wonderful old man, full of colorful stories about his past. One day he asked me for a Bible. It never occurred to me that this man had never had a Bible. So I just picked an RSV off the shelf of the church, took it down and gave it to him. And a week later, when I went to visit him, he was sitting by the window in his apartment, and I let myself in, and as soon as he saw me, he picked up the Bible from the windowsill and started to throw it at me. And he said, "There's nothing in here that you taught me." He had made it to the middle of Leviticus. And I thought to myself, well, of course. What did I do just handing this man a Bible? You know, you can't. The Gideons don't even do that. They give you a little pamphlet that says, read the Gospel of Mark first or something. So the question of a starting point is a critical one, a crucial one. And it does not leap out at us, even from the Gospel of Mark, that the resurrection is in fact the starting point. But I want to maintain that there would not even be a Gospel of Mark without the event of the resurrection itself. Jesus would be one more victim of Roman oppression, whose memory would last as long as there were people who loved him and learned from him, and then he would disappear into the ocean of time, the way so many, many people before and since have disappeared. The very fact that there is a gospel at all, that there are in fact four of them, that there are in fact volumes of documents contemporary with the gospels at all, they owe their existence to the resurrection. One of my teachers at the University of Heidelberg said in his book, The New Testament, A Guide to Its Writings, this is Günter Bornkamm, who just died, the Gospels and the Jesus tradition they enshrine are rooted in the certainty of the resurrection of Christ. It may sound like nonsense, but we venture to say that the gospel story begins with its end. For Jesus' Jewish opponents and for the Roman occupying power, there could be no doubt that his end on the cross was the annulment of his story. But for the disciples, the appearances of the risen one and their experience of his presence in the Spirit meant that his end was a new beginning in the sense of a final and absolute act of God for the salvation of the world. Men had condemned Jesus, but God turned their no into a yes, and in that yes, God committed himself to the world that rejected him. Robert Smith, in his book, The Easter Gospels, wrote, "The Gospels are Easter books not only because they end as they do, they are Easter books from the beginning to the end, penned by people who in various ways knew Jesus as raised from the dead, forever alive and mighty." And if one looks at the sermons of Acts, they aren't concerned primarily with the cross. That was something the Jews did, or the Romans did, or you did, is what Peter would say to people. What they're concerned to proclaim is, Jesus has been raised from the dead. And for them, this meant everything. Everything has been changed. So there are various ways in which this formula appears, Jesus raised from the dead. Sometimes it's Jesus is the Messiah. But in whatever way the formula appears, that's the starting point of Christian proclamation. It is, and if you say to yourself, but weren't there stories of resurrections? One would have to say, yes, there were also in the stories about Jesus, but they are not primarily resurrections, they are resuscitations. People who resumed an existence that they had had before and for whom death still lies ahead. Forgotten who it is, but somebody tells the story of Lazarus, who is one of the people who's resuscitated and who says, it's more terrible now because I have to die again. And in that sense, the proclamation at least of what occurred in Jesus is quite different even from the stories of resuscitation that circulated in advance. The earliest written account that we have of the resurrection of Jesus is 1 Corinthians 15. And Paul introduces this with a tradition formula I delivered to you what I also received. You got to think bucket brigade here, a tradition formula. But notice one very interesting thing about it. Among all the witnesses of the resurrection, there aren't any women. Now, Paul is a shrewd portrayer of this good news, and he knows that to add women to the list of resurrection witnesses is not going to strengthen the story. In fact, it will weaken it. I want to come back to this in a moment, but just hold it in your minds for a moment. Because witnesses, women as witnesses in Roman and Jewish society were not regarded as reliable. You couldn't convict anybody on the testimony of a woman of anything. So when Paul lists all the witnesses of the resurrection there, there aren't any. The only point I want to make here is that another one of my teachers at Heidelberg, Hans von Kampenhausen, says the story in Paul, the tradition, the paradosis that he hands on from one to another, goes back to within months, at most maybe 18 months, of the actual event itself. He thinks one can trace it back to the as close to the actual occurrences as possible. The accounts that we have in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as well as 1 Corinthians 15, vary in details. Do the women encounter the messenger, the angelos, the angel, inside or outside? Are there one or two? Are the grave cloths folded, or are they dispersed? Are they scattered? Are they strewn about? The details don't agree. These discrepancies are not so much problems as they are, some kind of testimony to the independence of the various narratives. This is not a kind of concocted story in which everybody gets together and says, all right, let's all agree now and let's get our story straight. At the core of these stories, I would want to include the following elements. The first is that the tomb is empty, there is some kind of real continuity between whoever was crucified and buried and whoever encountered the disciples after that event. Secondly, the women among the earliest witnesses. If in fact it were the case that women could not serve as valid witnesses, why do they show up then a generation later? If Paul manages to get rid of them in the earliest written narrative of the account, why do they show up in all the other Gospels? Answer, you can't leave them out. It's one of the very ironies of history that the inadmissibility of women as witnesses in the first century makes them very powerful witnesses in a critical postmodern age like our own. I mean, it's the way God laughs in derision at whatever it is that we intend. So I think it's a very important point that the second generation literature, the Gospels, have to tell the resurrection story with women included. It doesn't strengthen their case at all, you see. But they have to tell that the women are witnesses because that's the way it happened. Thirdly, there were no eyewitnesses of the actual event itself. I mean, nobody is there to record how the stone ends up being where it is and what it is that happened. So something like this gorgeous painting of Matthias Grünewald in the Isenheim altar in Colmar, France, of the resurrection. Dazzling, absolutely dazzling. That's imagination. We don't know what exactly happened. Fourth, the disciples, men and women, are encountered by appearances of the risen Jesus contrary to their expectations. Ronald Knox is the one who, for me at least, first pointed it out, that the resurrection narratives do not have any of the characteristics of hallucination or mirage. In mirage and hallucination, you see what you want to see. You want to see something so badly that your mind sort of invents it, projects it on the space around you. You want to see water in the desert, so you crawl towards that water that you see only to discover that it isn't there when you get there. The resurrection narratives have nothing of that character or quality to them. The disciples are not expecting anything at all to happen. And when they encounter Jesus in the stories that we have, they often don't even recognize him. They don't know who is there at all. And when they do, they are terrified out of their wits, so that the first word has to be a kind of calming word. Don't be frightened. Be comforted. It really is me, or some such thing. Or in some narratives, like Luke's account of the Emmaus disciples, they can walk a long ways and get into the house, and it isn't until the bread is broken with the words of that last meal that their eyes are opened and they suddenly know what's happening to them. And finally, the disappearances. Every one of the stories of appearances ends with a disappearance. The question we want to ask always is, where did Jesus go? Or, which is another version of the question, where is Jesus now? Up until the modern world, the 18th, 19th century, the answer always was, Jesus went up, up, and away. So he ends up being somewhere outside of our space-time continuum. That, again, is another thing that won't...
Try to imagine, just for a moment, where outside of the universe would be. I can't even imagine it. I mean, not in an age of the Hubble telescopes and Jupiter probes and everything that we know about the vastness of the universe. Where would outside of it be? I mean, you can think of outside as long as the sky is a comfortable little canopy slightly farther from us than the ceiling of Koinonia, right? But try to imagine where out of this world would be. Impossible. Impossible for me. Jürgen Moltmann's suggestion is, I think, one of the most elegant and Lutheran ones that I've ever encountered. Namely, Jesus disappears into the future and is therefore not gone. For he is present with his disciples as the power of the future. That's an astonishing answer to the question, what do the disappearances mean? I was in Leipzig in 1985 to do some teaching at the Lutheran Theological Seminary there, and I was my leaving coincided with the last week of the Bach festival that celebrated Bach's 300th birth anniversary. And one of the days of that Bach week was Ascension Day, and I went to the Nikolai Kirche, the church where all these demonstrations started that eventually ended in the sort of liberation of East Germany. And the Nikolai Choir sang Bach's Ascension Oratorio. The text is awful. Bach could have set the telephone directory to music and it would have been wonderful, so you still enjoy the evening. But the text is awful. The disciples are all saying, oh, don't leave us, dear Jesus, we'll be so sad, you know, you're going away. If you look at the book of Acts, however, in the Gospel of Luke, you discover they don't say anything like this at all. They come back to Jerusalem rejoicing. They haven't said goodbye. They have not said goodbye. And the reason they have not said goodbye is they do not experience the absence of Jesus. How is that thinkable for us today? It is thinkable if we think of this in terms of Jesus ascending into the future and therefore being available to us and present to us as the power of the future. I'm going to come back to this in a moment. But this is the core of the resurrection testimony, witness in the New Testament. What does all this mean? I think it means, first of all, that we must distinguish the resurrection of Jesus from the resuscitations that I mentioned earlier. The concept of resurrection owes its origin to 2 Maccabees 7, where Jewish martyrs under Antiochus Epiphanes IV all say, you can kill us, but that will not be the end of the story. God will raise us. Now, this is an important moment because it is the beginning of the very concept of martyrdom. When I first thought about this, it was a little surprising. You think that the things we think have always been around, but they haven't. Martyrdom means the freedom to endure death because one believes that that is only a penultimate, a second last event, not a final event, that there's more to the story which the inflictors of death don't know about. And so in 2 Maccabees 7, we have the beginning of the concept of martyrdom. It's an astonishing thing to think about. But it is not yet what the Gospels themselves proclaim. What happens in Jesus is something that both fulfills and transcends, bursts open the categories of martyrdom, because in Maccabees they would simply resume their existence and live it out to its full 70 years and 10 or 80 or whatever it would be. But in Jesus, one has an entirely different event, namely, one in which death itself has been finally transcended by one who can therefore make unconditional promises. And that's the second point. In the encounter with Jesus after his execution, the disciples encountered the outcome of history itself. I always think about this in terms of the way I read mystery novels. I hate to fly, and I need to distract myself as much as possible, and I can't do it by working on an airplane. Work is not a distraction for me, so I need something else, and I read mysteries. I'm reading currently some wonderful mysteries by Ellis Peters, a woman who writes about a medieval monk, Brother Cadfael, who solves mysteries like the hero of Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose. But at any rate, I read mysteries, and I always read them by reading the last chapter first. I know you're groaning, but it's the only way I can spare myself from reading the novel twice. And because it tells me, first of all, what characters to get emotionally involved in. I only have a limited amount of emotional involvement available to me, and I'm not going to invest my emotional energies in characters that aren't going to be around at the end. And secondly, it enables me to read the plot of the novel, which I don't know from reading the outcome, it enables me to read the plot by noticing now all the clues. So I participate in the novel differently when I know the end than I would if I didn't know it. That's what the disciples experienced when they encountered Jesus. They saw the last chapter. They didn't know the plot of history, but they knew the last chapter. And this changes the way they participate in history. With one significant difference, I cannot rewrite the plot of an Agatha Christie novel or a Ellis Peters novel or a P.D. James mystery or so on. I can't rewrite the plot. It's copyrighted. That's the way it is. But history is not copyrighted. We are making history every minute that we live. And the way in which we envision the outcome determines the way in which we are going to make history. I'll come back to this in a moment, but hold it for a moment. Because what the disciples encountered was literally for them the outcome of history. That's the meaning of the resurrection. Jesus is the one who determines the final future of all of humanity, all of the earth, all of creation, all of the universe. In Jesus and no other, that final determination has been disclosed to us. Death will not have the last word. That's what it means. Now, how we believe that determines the way we're going to invest ourselves in history. And how we invest ourselves in history shapes history itself, changes history. I'll come back to that. The last point is that Jesus is able to make unconditional promises to us. Lutheran theology has traditionally defined the gospel as promissio, as promise, as something we are promised. And therefore, to believe in Jesus is to believe that particular promise. The promise that life and not death, that the kingdom of God and not the reign of death, that Jesus and no one else will be the future of all of us. That's the power. In a sense, therefore, we are required to re-envision the future. That is to say, we do not re-envision the future any longer in terms of the powers of death, which seem to control the future. If I believe in the powers of death, I will accommodate myself to them in order to survive as long as possible, to get along, to make my peace with whatever is running the show. But if I believe in Jesus as the final word, I don't have to make my peace with whoever is running the show. That's what gives power to people like Bonhoeffer or Nelson Mandela or our current colleague here in the village, Mofeli. It is awesome, you see, to contemplate what that means for the way in which one lives one's life. And that's the last point I want to make now. The consequences are enormous. First of all, for theology. Theologos, the words about God. We now have a new way, or I should say probably a newly grounded way of thinking what God means. God means whoever has the power of the future. See, otherwise prayer doesn't make any sense. Whatever we pray to, we think is capable of determining the future. Christians are the ones who say to pray to whoever raised Jesus from the dead, or whatever was involved in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, is what we mean by God. God means whoever or whatever determines the future, and in this case, whoever or whatever is involved in the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. There are many other meanings for God and many other attempts to validate the meaning for God, but Christians are people who believe that whatever or whoever is involved in the resurrection of Jesus is what we mean when we use the word God. Secondly, the consequences for authority, for whatever or whoever authorizes action. I want to cite two very unlikely and almost incompatible witnesses at this point. One is Letty Russell, and the other is Bishop John Zizioulas, a Greek Orthodox theologian and currently titular bishop of something or other. John Zizioulas, in his book Being as Communion, says that and I'm interested in this because of my ecumenical involvement, says that ecumenism will not make any advances at all unless we take seriously the gospel as a word about the final future of humanity, of the world, of the universe, and therefore of the church. Letty Russell is more direct. She's in her book, The Household of Freedom. She raises the question, why in the world can we have the ordination of women when there is no precedent for it anywhere in Christian history? Answer, the authority for this comes from what will be, not what has been. With that marvelous word, I went scurrying to the New Testament to look up all the usages of the Greek word exousia, authority. And I discovered that it has, like a lot of words, several meanings. It can be Pilate's authority to execute Jesus or Herod's authority to question him. But it can also mean Jesus' own authority, which is quite different from Pilate's or Herod's. And the contrast comes when the Gospels, the Synoptic Gospels, record that Jesus' authority was not like that of the scribes. Scribal authority in the New Testament means, I'm quoting here the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, the main business of the scribes was interpreting and teaching the Torah. That is, the transmission of legal precedents for what had been done in the past. I was in Duluth a few years ago for a Lutheran-Jewish conversation, and one of the rabbis there made a marvelous comment. He says, Judaism rejected the notion of moving into the future in terms of prophetic insight, because you always had to decide whether it was a true prophet or a false prophet, and substituted instead moving into the future on the basis of legal precedent. By legal they meant the precedent of the Torah, the interpretation of the Torah. He said, this is a safe way to move into the future, because the future isn't going to be radically different than the past. So you take precedent and you move into the future. Now the problem with this is, on the one hand, that the only certain thing about the future is death rate is 100%, one per person. But secondly, if you're going to move into the future on the basis of precedent, you can only move into the future on the basis of those who already have a stake in the present. You're not going to do anything radically new, because the people who are most interested in the past and its precedents are those who already have their place made for them, right? My class, we're terribly interested in the laws of this land, because the laws protect what little it is that Jan and I have managed to accumulate in our lifetime, and which may see us through to our death, if inflation and taxes and a few other things don't strip us of all of this. So we're very interested in precedent and the whole legal system, but the legal system protects the position of people who already have a stake in the present. It does not give anybody who doesn't have a stake in the present possibilities. When Jesus' authority, authorization, is contrasted with the authorization of the scribes, it is the authorization of one who says, this is the way things will be. And therefore, Jesus gives possibility to people who don't have a stake in the present. Which is exactly why the church can argue for something like the ordination of women that Carol went out to celebrate, and that we all ought to celebrate, not on the basis of how much precedent there is for this, but on the fact that it is the way in the kingdom of God things will be. See, it is the way we must argue for every oppressed, persecuted group. They do not have a stake in the present. They need promissio. They need promise. They need someone who can envision what will happen. But Christians envision what will happen, not in a utopian way, you know, oh, wouldn't this be nice, but on the grounds of one who has the power of the future by virtue of the resurrection. And finally, the consequences for the church are that it is called to be a representative, not of precedent, but of promise. It is called to anticipate what will be in its being. Hence, in order to become a part of the community of the church, nothing short of conversion is required of us, because we have to stop thinking of what has been and what will be guaranteed for us, and become instead the community of anticipation, which is a risky place to be. We're out on a limb. Friday. I'm going to talk about Jesus, the liberating Redeemer, and the mission of the gospel on Friday.
Oh, I'm sorry, I wouldn't be able to be here.
You got to just anticipate it. Figure it. No, that's a good question. How would you take what I have said here now and try to understand this as liberating, as freeing? What does that mean for you, that it's too much of this world? What have I said that is not sort of very, very much oriented to this world and the way we work in it and live in it? Well, let me just ask this question then. What are the things that liberation theology is about? for starters.
Well, I'm asking you because I know something about it.
Well, one of the things liberation theology is about is sort of giving a chance to the poor. Isn't that what it's about?
Which is very...
In a way, it's impossible to respond without sort of trying to do another whole presentation.
No, but I get the feeling you're putting me on the stick.
I'm not trying to. I'm really not. Well, what I am trying to say is that the church's commitment to any enterprise that gives hope and promise to people who otherwise would not have it has got to be part of Jesus' own mission and the vision that animates us if we are in fact living out of the resurrection. Now, maybe one of the things we might want to do is to argue with liberation theology over the means by which the church goes about this, but hardly over its ends, I would think. I'm not trying to anticipate what I want to do on Friday, but
wouldn't you say that most of evangelical Christianity would argue over the ends as well? What does the gospel hope and promise? What hope and promise does the gospel bring? Is it that there will be equal distribution of land? Is it democratic as opposed to authoritarian or totalitarian civil government? Or is it strictly what the world would say, pie in the sky and wait till you die? Or what is it? So I would respectfully disagree that there would be unanimity about hope and promise, the end.
Uh-huh.
Like the means and the end is at the root of where liberation theology and much of what might be described as evangelical Christianity quite people.
That's a good point. But it seems to me difficult to go through the passages of the New Testament that deal with Jesus' authority and not find him as representative of an authority that comes from what will be. And therefore capable of giving hope to people who otherwise had no hope.
Hope of what?
Can we bracket that for a moment, or I should say for some further discussion? The messianic age that the resurrection inaugurates, in according to the New Testament, is not limited to. To an otherworldly hope. It's not limited to that. It can't be. It's one of the reasons why the earliest disciples of Jesus were such an attraction for people who otherwise had no hope, of various kinds. Women, orphans, hardly any doubt, for example, that the disciples of Jesus had a place for girl babies who were otherwise abandoned by Roman families because they were a drag on the family fortune or the family future, and that the church rescued them and gave them hope. For people with diseases that were otherwise shunned by contemporaries. And in fact, through Christian history, the people who were able to respond
creatively, compassionately to a variety of diseases is, I think, testimony to the kind of thing I'm talking about. What hope were these people given? Hardly in many instances cured, but certainly the kind of care and compassion that made hospitals once almost exclusively Christian operations. It doesn't mean to say, see, I think a lot of the things that the Christian Church pioneered have been institutionalized so that now today we expect them. But
public education, hospitals.
One could go on with the list, but what was happening in every instance was the giving of some kind of hope to people who otherwise had none, or giving a stake in the future to people who didn't have one guaranteed by precedent. Now, is the hope that one gives to a person who is dying simply by compassionate care, is that the only hope available? I would want to say on the basis of the Christian gospel, no, that's not the only hope. Is it a sign of that hope? Well, we have the gospels, I think, to bear witness to that. I'm not trying to pick a fight with so-called evangelicals at this point. In fact, what I'm trying to say takes the New Testament almost at face value, which is what evangelicals do. And I'm trying to say, if one starts with the resurrection, then what one ends up with is a marvelously hopeful, promising presence of both ways for identifying God, ways for making sense out of the event of Jesus, ways for being the church, but I think we must say more. That's why this is a five-part series, but at least I've tried to make a case for this as a starting point. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I'll be your friend.
Oh, good. Please.
Well, Helmut Tielicke makes quite an issue. My reading, of course, much of it is a little in the past for me now, but that Jesus was not a social reformer. And where you see that a great emphasis, and he does not use the word, theology that we're speaking of, but on the other hand, he always refers to it as a straw fire. On the other hand, if you listen to some of the sermons, maybe you did, maybe you didn't, the great Walter Meyer, I remember the sermon on Jesus' burial. He said, now, this should immediately teach us that he is the savior of the world, and then didn't go out on the string, you know, and go ahead and reform hotels because there's no place for him.
Wednesday. Wednesday I'm going to talk about what it means that Jesus is the Messiah. And I want to say sort of a yes and a no to that. Okay? We can't do it all in one. Last word. We got to quit.
Well, I was just going to say, in regard to some of these questions, I think that's the only way the healings make sense in the gospel. Jesus didn't look at someone who needed healing and say, well, you'll be healed in the hereafter. I mean, he healed them right then, here in this world. It seems like that's what you're talking about. How, if we have the end in mind, it influences how we deal with it.
Yes, it makes sense of current involvement. See, and I don't want to just for your comfort, I don't want to say that spells out a program of social reform. But it does change the way the church involves itself in the world.
Well, I guess that's the purpose.
Okay. This is wonderful. I'll be back when? Tomorrow, 10:45.